The Stargate program, at face value, was a program that was started by the military and basically engaging in studies to start to understand, I guess you would say, the concept of consciousness and how it may be utilized in the espionage world. What we're learning now is that this program was not strictly limited to adults, but that they were also working with children, which is where I found myself involved with the program. And in regards to oddities on the topic, basically I would just say that, you know, you're not supposed to be administering drugs in the form of eye drops to children without their parents knowing. They were running me through the Robert Monroe Institute's remote viewing protocols and seemingly trying to utilize me as a child for some sort of intelligence gathering operation. Alan Dulles fell for the hustle. They would utilize Mrs. Ballantyne like a honeypot. Mr. Ballantyne and his wife were basically entrapping people and utilizing that information as control methods. The United States submarine fleet was actively tunneling under the ice in Antarctica. When John asked his father what was the purpose, his father said, "Space operations." Now, people really need to sit and think about that for a second. Tesla technology, when we think of HARP in a typical sense, like over in Gokona, Alaska, it's built on the surface, so it has the dimensions of length and width in regards to it being a phased array. The system at the South Pole, because you add the depth of 1 kilometer into the ice, now gives it a third dimension to function off of, which has exponential gains in as so far as what they can accomplish and how they can direct it. This is the smoking gun for directed energy weapons and proves there's more going on. My name's Eric Hecker. I currently reside in Alaska. I grew up on Long Island. I had a very peculiar history of nefarious activity with the Stargate program, and I worked my way through the submarine service for a short stint. I made it over to the plumbing world on the Gold Coast of Long Island, which I'm learning and letting people know is, you know, the heart of the military industrial complex in the U.S. I worked in the homes for these people. I worked in their facilities where they were manufacturing the equipment at. And then I eventually wound up getting myself a contract at the South Pole Station for a year from November of 2010 until November of 2011. Certainly came across some peculiar stuff while I was present there, but it wasn't until a fistful of years later and doing due diligence to connect the dots that I understood, you know, how peculiar the path was that I've walked in life. The Stargate program, at face value, was a program that was started by the military and basically engaging in studies to start to understand, I guess you would say, the concept of consciousness and how it may be utilized in the espionage world. What we're learning now is that this program was not strictly limited to adults, but that they were also working with children, which is where I found myself involved with the program. And in regards to oddities on the topic, basically, I would just say that, you know, you're not supposed to be administering drugs in the form of eye drops to children without their parents knowing. There's a lot of questions to be asked exactly what that was. I do now know from research as an adult that what they weren't telling me as a child was they were running me through the Robert Monroe Institute's remote viewing protocols and seemingly trying to utilize me as a child for some sort of intelligence gathering operation or some means of a program, because we've also learned that they tried to take these remote viewing techniques to utilize for communications for people in the submarine service, and I later found myself in the submarine service. So I can't help but think that there was some intention applied to me in my youth. The military knows the product that they need, and we can see in the world around us that they're heavily invested into manufacturing the product that they want. The job that I was assigned in the submarine service was what they call a fire control technician, which is weapon systems to include up to nuclear-tipped weaponry. I think that they start working the system to manufacture the product sooner than we give them credit for currently. There seems to be value, not that I'm supporting this activity, but there seems to be value in traumatizing the psyche of a child to get what they call dissociative identity disorder, and that technically expands the consciousness to give them more to play with. Even what was happening in the school compared to what was going on in other schools was a bit more abusive in day-to-day operations, which, you know, I mean, in my brain, I just took that as normal day-to-day stuff, what other people would consider wholly abusive. But in my experience, I would say that the more aggressive abuse occurred off property, off school property, off the school property at a different facility. I would be removed from my classroom regularly, brought to the library in my school, and then some other facilities, one being the St. Ignatius Retreat House, which was over in an area near Roslyn, Long Island, which has now effectively been wholly removed off the face of the earth, and they're building a community of homes there. The history of this place is very referenceable still, even though now they've wiped this place off the face of the planet. Initially, the property was called Inishfada, which is Gaelic for Long Island, and it was owned by the Brady family, one of the more affluent families in the U.S. when the home was constructed. When the home was constructed, it was the fourth largest residence in the entirety of the United States. The Brady family was supremely connected with the Jesuits, and eventually the property was donated to the Jesuits. All the while, under Brady ownership and Jesuit ownership, the idea was that this property was built and utilized basically for the re-education of the boys of Long Island. And I can assure you that that re-education is not a process that you want your children going through. Outside of the abusive parts, it was the typical Robert Monroe Institute remote viewing protocols, where we would basically be producing an ideogram, which is, you know, basically a scribbling a line on a page, and then they would have you take the writing instrument, touch it to the line, and ask you a series of questions. Whatever comes to your head is right, which from my perspective as a child in that environment was so bizarre to me, because, you know, outside of the library in the classroom, it was a very old-fashioned Catholic school, very strict, right? If you were asked a question and you gave a wrong answer, you got hit with a ruler. There was repercussions for being wrong. But in the library, it was so confusing to me when they would say things like, just say the first thing that comes to your mind, whatever you say is right. I considered that environment bizarro world, because everything that was outside of the library would be normal. Everything that was inside of the library, in my youth, I had no comprehension. In regards to the eye drops and the sessions, I would there was always like a debrief at the end of whatever we were doing. We would go over stuff. And I always remember trying to expedite that portion so that I could exit the library. When you would exit the library, there was these giant glass windows that faced south. And it must have been the afternoon that the sun was coming in. And I always remember trying to get out there quickly, because I was cognizant that whatever it was that was in the eye drops had a side effect of making everything look yellow, as if you had, yellow lens sunglasses on. And I just thought that was cool. So I would try to expedite getting out there to, you know, reap this positive benefit. Funny fact was that just in my research out in Brooklyn with the producer, he said that he had done some research in regards to me stating this previously, and that there's something to be said about these types of eye drops causing this effect, and it was something to do with blocking out the blue light, that there's a high probability that these eye drops were intended for that, and that gives us some sort of different level of consciousness, that the blue light apparently impedes our ability to either think a certain way or have our consciousness expand a certain way. Again, just a new avenue for me to research, because I still wholly do not know exactly what these eye drops are or what their intended use was. There was a lot of peculiarity with the submarine service. just in general for how it's presented. Because things were peculiar, my intention was to get myself, the term is separated. I was trying to get separated from my contract with the United States Navy. I was approached, or I should say I was directed by another crew hand who said that there was a Raytheon technician that could help out folks like me, and he was helping him. So I met this Raytheon personnel, and he told me that he could certainly assist in my separation from the Navy if I would take part in what he was working on. So his, I guess you'd say, office was in a sub-level of Building 518, which was definitively a top-secret facility. That's where I was going to school. I had clearance. I had the badging to get there, so it was no problem for me to get to his office. And I went to his office to, you know, work with his project to gain my separation. Upon entering his office, there was like, you know, when you go to the emergency room and they have the railing mounted to the ceiling and the curtains close around what's normally like the gurney, the bed, right? So there was a brown curtain there. It was lit in there, and the curtains were wrapped around, you know, containing the light from that area. He proceeded to ask me to enter the room, and he opened the curtains. And what I saw was what to me at the time, it looked like kind of like a dental chair was surrounded by this curtain. And he instructed me to come on in, get in the chair, and we'll get started. I don't recall moving forwards to the chair. I don't recall getting into the chair. I just remember showing up to that room and being given that direction as the curtain was opened. Apparently, I became part of a program that got me out of another program, which is what I've researched and found out, is that once you get yourself caught up in one of these programs, you don't ever really get out. And if you attempt to get out, they will fake an exit door for you, but that exit door is actually an entry into a more nefarious program. There was a time I was at the New London train station, just, you know, going to jump a train, going to head back home to Long Island for the weekend. And there was a much older gentleman who approached me, and he self-identified as the executive officer of the USS Groton, a Los Angeles class submarine. I knew he was lying. We had been trained about, you know, espionage tactics and, you know, be careful, you know, you have privileged information, you are a target. I was young, I was bold. I said, oh, I want to see where this goes. This guy's obviously full of crapping, digging for info. He was asking a whole bunch of questions about things that I was trained on and told how to properly guard. But regardless, I was like, oh, wow, you know, I wonder if this guy is just from the base and I'll be in probe to see how good I am at deflecting this stuff. It was peculiar on every level. He offered to buy me a beer. I informed him I'm underage. You know, it was just like every angle of attack he could try to see if he can get me to do something wrong. So long story short, I wound up going for a stroll with this guy as he attempted to pick my brain and I attempted to deflect. And at one point, I said to him, you know, I got to get back to the train station. I got a train to catch. We jump in a cab. I remember looking in my watch, getting into that cab. And it should have been a couple of minute ride. When we got to the train station and I went to exit the cab, I went to look at my watch again. I had lost 20 minutes worth of time. And it freaked me the hell out because it's not a concept in my head that I had ever considered up until that point, but I could not shed that knowledge of what the hell just happened. Like, this is, you know, it's been way more than a few minutes, about 20 minutes more than it should have been. And I exited the cab. I departed from being in the presence of that person and carried on with my life. There wasn't much I could do about it. I never reported the activity because the 20 minutes of lost time freaked me out. If that didn't occur, I probably would have reported it and just said, hey, you know, I got probed at the train station, something fishy, you guys might want to pay more attention over in that area. But now go quite a few years in the future, I find myself, you know, I did plumbing. You know, if you had my phone number and you said you had a leak, I'd say, all right, Mr. Anderson, I'm on my way over. I don't really have control of where I show up. I go to where the customers are. I wind up in Roslyn, Long Island, which my research is showing is pretty much the heart of the American espionage community from way back when George Washington initiated the ball rolling in the creation of the U.S. Here I am in the basement of a customer that calls me to their house, and I'm doing a boiler repair. So I'm in the boiler room, went over the prices with the guy, he agreed, I'm in the middle of making the repair, and having gone through the home, very affluent home, I get down into the basement. This guy literally has like Tesla coils all over his basement. It looks like a science lab in this guy's basement. Now, at this time in my adulthood, I have started connecting some dots. I had start doing some research. It was post 9/11. My brain was turned on to things are not as what we seen. With that being said, he was standing in the doorway, watching me work and initiating a conversation in regards to all kinds of conspiracy related things. And we were dialoguing. I was enjoying the conversation. It was a breath of fresh air in that environment in New York at the time that this guy was at least open to these topics. As we started mowing through the topics, it clicked. I was down on a knee on the side of the boiler, and all of a sudden, like, just I looked, and I, at that moment, realized. And he realized that I realized that he was the guy from the train station. Yes. So I got up, and I said, listen. I said, you called me here. I said, I didn't come knocking on your door. I said, what's going on? And he laughed because this was his doing, right? He called me there. I called him out. Effectively, I guess you would say we became friends, for lack of a better term. And I found out the history of who this man was, his family, and their association to the OSS and the CIA. And he proceeded over the course of weeks, months, to start educating me on, I guess you would say, Tesla technology, the CIA, how it was created through the OSS, and his family's association to that process. And I got quite the education. And this all occurred, I would say, just prior to me going to the South Pole station. It was like I was being read in to have a higher level of understanding before I was going to become privy to more stuff. His name was Toby Circus Ballantyne. He was born on the circus ground. He himself is one of the most famous clowns of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, probably only outdone by his father, who was Bill Ballantyne, who was the lead propagandist for the OSS and one of the big hands in transitioning the OSS with the injection of Operation Paperclip Nazis to create what we now know as the CIA. He explained to me that the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus was basically subsidized by the efforts of his father working with the U.S. government under the concept of it being morale boosting. So the federal government proceeded to start paying for the circus during World War II and was, I guess you'd say, a repository for placing people that they don't necessarily want to have in any other place and not have people ask a lot of questions. As an example of that referenceable history, Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus summer property. You know, these used to be traveling circuses, right? But only weather permitting. So where they summered was in an area in Florida known as Venice. This is where the Clown College was, that Bill Ballantyne, the father, became the dean of Clown College, where they would teach clowns, not agents, the secrets of basically how to work a room. A lot of what clowning is agent skills. So now you can imagine if a crew of clowns came into a room in full regalia, how they could get the attention of everybody in the room and work the crowd. Well, what happens if these same people have the same skills, but don't wear the outfits? Are they any less talented, or now can they be put to a different task? These are the skills that they train people in. So Venice, Florida is where these clowns would train. The circus donated to the property of Venice, Florida, from 9/11 fame, where the terrorist pilots apparently trained at. That was former circus grounds. It's the only airport of that size in the U.S. that has no air traffic control tower. People just come and go to their discretion. So all these things, they're all connected. People don't pay attention to the history of stuff, but these are things that, you know, again, in the deciphering of my experience and trying to figure out my past and who I've worked in proximity to, this is one person who straight up was like, listen, here's the deal. My dad was the lead propagandist for the OSS. He helped convert the OSS into the CIA. He even went as so far as to tell me, this is how stuff works, and this is what I was told. His father was married to a woman in the circus. I cannot remember her name, but she was considered freakishly beautiful. Like, that was her job. Look beautiful in the circus. Put on the fancy outfits. Bill Ballantyne was bisexual. This is what his son told me, Toby. They were hustling people. Alan Dulles fell for the hustle. They would utilize Mrs. Ballantyne like a honeypot. They would set up the gentleman in a drunken stupor. And then next thing you know, Alan Dulles is getting manipulated by Bill. So they get him caught into a homosexual activity. And next thing you know, they have Alan Dulles with skeletons in the closet. This is the stuff that I was being told was going on, was that Mr. Ballantyne and his wife were basically entrapping people and utilizing that information as control methods. Agency activities operating under the false pretense of circus folk. But again, this is the history of the world that most people aren't paying attention to. It's an old school game. Apparently the only thing they transitioned from is now that homosexual activity is not as verboten as it was back then, now they switched the game to pedophilia. But either way, they're going to set you up to have skeletons in your closet so that you're infinitely manipulable in the future. They have to have that level of skeleton in your closet for you to make it that high up in the pyramid, so to say. And now that seems to be a lot more reality than I wish it were. It does appear to be obvious that around us, in our waking state, human trafficking, specific to child trafficking, is a rampant problem that needs to be addressed. A typical day on the ice started out in the morning. We did a stretch for a half an hour, which was good because the environment's very taxing. Obviously cold weather, super low oxygen content, and 0% humidity. It's very challenging for your body. You have to be very careful when you're working. It's very easy to tear your skin. Your skin becomes like tissue paper, and it does not heal quickly. So you have to learn new ways of doing things, be more patient. And for the most part, we spent our time, you know, making repairs, doing preventative maintenance, and we would joke around saying how boring it is. But then we would also joke around how we have the most boring job in the world that's broken up by moments of sheer terror, which would be when the alarms would go off. Because things would break, and in that environment, Mother Nature would basically put a crack in the dam of your safety, your life support systems. That crack in the dam is going to widen fast unless you do something about it and start taking down more life support systems. So when those alarms went off, things got very serious very quickly, and we would have to attend to, you know, was it a fire situation? Was it a power loss situation? Was it a compromise to our primary water supply? You know, what do we have to do to get this back up and running as fast as humanly possible. And I was the guy. So, I mean, you know, a lot of people bust my chops and say, oh, he's just some dumb plumber and he's just some dumb fireman. But that couldn't be farther from the truth. The reason that I was at the South Pole Station in that dual role capacity, quite frankly, is because I'm really awesome at what I do. And it takes a lot of intelligence to be in that environment and mitigate the problem rapidly before 49 people die. If not for what we call Facilities Engineering, Maintenance, and Construction, the FEMC department. The FEMC department is the brains of the South Pole Station. They're the ones that can work in those harsh conditions and overcome the forces of Mother Nature in an environment where she is already predetermined. She wants everything to be dead. Overcoming that intention is the challenge of being at the South Pole Station. Was there scuttlebutt going on in the chow hall that was interesting? Yeah, absolutely. Head surgeon that we had for my winter season, a gentleman by the name of James Borden, held the record for being the oldest person to ever winter at the South Pole Station. He was a very interesting character because I was always walking in and hearing him discuss his past. He was formerly a pilot for the CIA and a surgeon, and he would always be telling stories about his activities in Laos and Cambodia and all the different shenanigans going on. I believe he was probably a MACV SOG guy. And he'd be telling these stories, and I would always just walk up and I go, Doc, you know, we never admitted that we were in Laos in Cambodia. I'm like, I don't think you're supposed to be talking about this stuff to the general public. And he would just look at me and go, what are they going to do? Make me winter over at the South Pole Station? And then we would joke around too in the grand scheme of, you know, the big picture and all the accusations about Antarctica and peculiarity. I will say that I had the wherewithal going into the facility, knowing that I was hired by Raytheon, that things were going to be weird. Keep your head on a swivel, keep your head down, but absorb, pay attention, be like a sponge. But in regards to, I would say, going from suspicion to knowing something was rotten in the state of Denmark, so to say, was when I came across the ELF system being active. I was engaged in a repair, the replacement of a pump. I needed to de-energize the pump so that I could remove the pump, put in a new one, and then reconnect the electricity. When I went to the panel to disengage the power, things weren't really in the positions that they were labeled, so I was not confident that I was going to be de-energizing the right piece of equipment. And because this pump was for some really crazy fuel, I mean, fire is a concern. So I went through my chain of command to get confirmation as to what circuits were what. And in that process, I became privy to the fact that the ELF system that I was told was defunct and de-energized was actually up and running perfectly fine. So at that point was the line in the sand where I went from suspicion to, oh, this place is absolutely operating under false pretenses. The ELF at face value is something used for submarine communications, best case scenario. But what I'm learning is that there's other applications and that there's a high probability that it has, besides the covert aspect of submarine communications, which is questionable in regards to the Antarctic Treaty and military activities, the shades of gray there, which is probably first and foremost why they don't discuss it. But then in regards to contemporary weapons of warfare and directed energy weapons systems, there are things to be considering for that as well. My primary concern and understanding at the time was knowing that this system would consist of an antenna embedded in the ice that would cover miles of developed length of linear feet, and that there's a high probability that we, the crew, were simply riding on top of this antenna, and that it most certainly would be negatively impacting the personnel in proximity, which is probably also why they don't want to discuss why it's on. It would be years later that I discovered that the Ice Cube neutrino detector was not simply a passive device for observing neutrino reactions, that it has the ability to transmit, which is a document that I came across. I have it posted at my website. It's called the DOMS document. It's in the archives section. This is the smoking gun for directed energy weapons and proves there's more going on. The DOM document states very clearly that each of the DOMs, which there are 5,160 of them, this is what makes it a phased array, can transmit it up to 2,047 volts each. So it is technically the world's largest phased array transmitter, and it's slated to be increased in 10 times its size. People have to really ask what really is going on at face value, right? If they're saying that it's simply detecting neutrinos for the purposes of science, what's the return on investment for the money invested so far? Was it worth it? What's the price per neutrino detected? And is it worth making it 10 times bigger? What do we, the people, actually get out of investing in this for what it's supposed to be? Basically, it's a building on top of the ice that they run a lot of wiring and cabling out to embed in the ice. The DOMs are about the size of a basketball. So it's called the ice cube for a reason, because it's 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer, hence the cube portion. It's a massive array embedded in the ice. They basically bore down in the ice, making, you know, a column that they remove the ice from by melting the ice with hot water. That's all it takes, hot water, you melt the ice. For the regular folk out there, as they always talk about how hard it is to get down in the ice. That's just a bold-faced lie. The only thing you need to do is pour water on the ice and watch it recede. The ice is minus 60 degrees. You pour water on it at 40 degrees, and you can watch it just go away. It's an activity that I've been involved with. So they basically remove the ice. They drop down a steel cable with the DOMs connected to it, and then they refill that space with water that freezes again, and now effectively this system is impregnated in the ice, and it has three-dimensional capacity. So Tesla technology, when we think of HARP in a typical sense, like over in Kokona, Alaska, it's built on the surface, so it has the dimensions of length and width in regards to it being a phased array. The system at the South Pole, because you add the depth of 1 kilometer into the ice, now gives it a third dimension to function off of, which has exponential gains in as so far as what they can accomplish and how they can direct it. At the very least for earthquakes and or weather manipulation, and that seems to be observable in the world around us. I took this document along with my experiences and some other maps and things like that. And when I went to Washington, D.C. in June of 2023, this is what I laid at the feet of both the Senate Intelligence Committee and ARRO. We spoke in depth about what's going on with directed energy weapons at the South Pole Station. They thanked me for my testimony. They understood, appreciated it. They said it was going to be put into the National Archives and expedited to Congress, is what they told me at that time. I had an appreciation for their appreciation and thought that they were going to do something with it. I had hoped that we would have seen some sort of grander activity down on the ice to engage shutting down such systems. But I appreciate that even if that was their intention, it might be more challenging than I had hoped. Because at the end of the conversation, at the end of the testimony, we got into conversation. They, appreciating what I just shared with them, said to me, you know, it's obvious that there are rogue factions with access to technology that are operating without the oversight of the American government and just, you know, doing whatever they want to do. And the conversation was basically, you know, what do we all think should be done about this? I was straight up pushing for, like, go invade the South Pole, send in the troops, shut that thing down. Like, what's the holdup? I'm still waiting to see some sort of positive activity, I guess you would say, by what we consider conventional forces, against these rogue factions that are wielding way more advanced technology. No one seems to know exactly who's doing the dastardly deeds. What we do know, at the very least, is that the National Science Foundation keeps giving checks to military industrial corporation weapons manufacturers, keep getting the contract to provide the contract for life support systems, right? Firefighters, plumbers, culinary crew, janitors, right? There's other companies that provide those services that don't make weapons, right? Why do the weapons manufacturers keep getting contracts for janitorial teams and culinary teams and maintenance teams. I mean, what does weaponry seem to be the common denominator for whoever gets the contracts? Raytheon was there. The Navy was there. Now Lockheed Martin was there. I mean, who's going to get the next contract? Is it just going to bounce back to Raytheon again? You know, are they just going to keep passing it back and forth? And who are these military industrial contractors that seem to have the power to keep gleaning these contracts? You know, who's involved in these conversations? You know, I don't know who's running it, but there has to be some sort of a paper trail of communications to who is running it. I mean, what, you know, we have to put effort into this stuff. Oftentimes people ask me because they say, you know, Eric, what you're suggesting indicates that there has to be a greater amount of power available, to which I wholly agree. I do not believe that the CAT generators that we were using for our regular primary power source can take this load. So in my research, I've had the benefit of meeting John Warner IV. You've met this person. He's a very interesting person. He's very informed. He's done a lot of research. His father was formerly the Secretary of the Navy, which would put Operation Deep Freeze under his purview during his time in that role. John loves his father. John really believes that his father was up to good and against bad. John and I had very amicable conversations, and I'm sure John has no problem with me saying this, but I have suggested to him, John, maybe you don't have your dad as dialed in as you thought. And he, I don't want to think that way, but I can't, you know, I don't like to think that way, but maybe you're right. But in these conversations that John and I have had, you know, he stated that before his father passed away, John, obviously interested in the topic, said to Dad, you know, Dad, what's with all the Navy activity going on down in Antarctica? What's with submarines? I know there's a lot of secrecy. His father told him the United States submarine fleet was actively tunneling under the ice in Antarctica. When John asked his father what was the purpose, his father said, space operations. Now, people really need to sit and think about that for a second. How do you connect the United States Navy to space operations through Antarctica? I will apply extrapolation from my experience. Can I prove this? All is doing exactly this? No. But it is referenceable that this absolutely could be going on from everything else we do know. Okay? So we have United States Navy submarines under the ice in Antarctica, as told to us by the former Secretary of the Navy. We have my experience at the South Pole Station showing that it's very easy to bore from 9,300 feet of elevation down the ice all the way down to the bottom, which is where the submarines could be now. In my time in the United States Navy, I was taught that the Los Angeles class submarines, all Navy submarines are nuclear powered. One of the things they state, the purpose of a nuclear submarine, is that heaven forbid there's a power outage in the United States of America, we could just simply pull a submarine up off the coast, connect that cable, and provide them power. How come we've never seen that occur? I mean, there was a power outage in the greater Northeast U.S. shortly after 9/11. How come they just didn't pull a submarine up and give them the power they needed? But with that being said, since a submarine could power a whole city and get underneath the ice in Antarctica, for which the ice could be drilled and connected, I would suggest that there's a high likelihood that the submarine activity in Antarctica would be for powering facilities that are not on the radar. It's not that it's not happening, right? They tell us in the design aspect and the list of functions that is possible. What they're not telling us is when they are doing it and where, right? So let's just look at the big picture of possibility also, right? You know, a lot of people look at the bottom of our oceans. So wouldn't it also be possible if they could provide this service for facilities in Antarctica? is it impossible to consider that there might be facilities at the bottom of the ocean that also need rotating power supplies? 70% of our planet's covered in water. I happen to know there's problems at the South Pole Station. So now if we're just two gentlemen thinking about where might other facilities be on the planet that they're not telling us about on this planet that's covered 70% in water and all nations seem to be building submarines at a furious pace we've never seen before. How about we start discussing what's going on in the bottom of the oceans and who controls that environment? Because if I remember correctly, once you leave the coastline of every nation and you get out into the middle of the seas of the planet, there's no laws out there. And what we're learning is that when technology or anything is unbeknownst to we the people, it's wholly unregulated. It's really unregulated in areas where, similar to the Antarctic Treaty, out in the oceans, everybody's already agreed to lawlessness out there. Every rogue faction and or known nation state is pretty much given carte blanche to do whatever they want out there. Is anybody asking any questions about that activity? The United States Submarine Service has a program called Cormorant, which is a drone that can be deployed from a submerged submarine and brought back in a submerged state. That would, I mean, by definition, be a USO. It's just that now they're talking about it contemporarily. What if the program's been going on for 30 years? So all of a sudden this thing just shoots up out of the water, flies around, does things that no manned aircraft could do. Yeah, because it's a drone. There's no man in it, so it can cut different angles and things like that. So we have to change our perspective in time and space and presentation and realize that these programs have been around our entire lives, and they're playing games, right? So let's look at Operation Cormorant with this type of thing popping out of the water. If this was happening 40 years ago, right, and all of a sudden some guy in a boat says, man, I saw this thing come out of the water. It looked damn kind of weird, like a cormorant bird, which the thing does. Like, it's a very peculiar alien-looking shaped vessel. It doesn't really look like man-made aerodynamics that we're familiar with even today. So we'll go back 30, 40 years. We'll say this thing pops up out of a Los Angeles-class submarine. Some fisherman sees it, right, and goes, oh, my God, I saw a UFO. Well, the way the government respond would be that they'd send over fine old Richard Doty to convince him he's right. Yep, that was a UFO. Wow, it's amazing that you saw a UFO. There's literally people paid to do that activity, to convince people that what is actually man-made is not. They say tic-tac. Why don't they just say submarine-shaped? You know, because they're playing with words, they're controlling the narrative, and they're very specific about the vernacular that they're throwing out there and investing in. You know, like you said, that there seems to be these groups. Like, this is what I'm learning in the disclosure community, right? Is that I'm trying to put information out there, and I'm just seeing forces line up against me trying to control the narrative on the topic of Antarctica. You know, there's the I come out, I bring a verifiable, actionable intelligence. I bring it as far as Washington, D.C. I bring it to the community. For years, I attempt to make this information public and get people on this conversation. And I consistently get folks like Linda Moulton Howe, Brad Olson, Dr. Sala, who are like, oh, but wait, we have an anonymous whistleblower that said that there's cities under the ice and massive bismuth doors. And it's like, got any proof? Like, why are you trying to keep changing the subject? That's the way I look at it. Why do people keep trying to change the subject, control the narrative, and focus the attention of all of the people in the wrong direction? This is how the circus works. You have a ringmaster. He lights up and says, look over here, while the other rings are preparing for the next act. And all I keep seeing in the disclosure commodity is that the next act keeps being presented with no substance. But they keep that light on so that the people are focused on the non-substance. I've been thinking, like, I'm sure you've probably heard this before in the disclosure commodity, right? You hear people, podcasters and stuff, they say, you know, Eric, I think you're being a little bit harsh. I'm just a podcaster. I like to put all of the information out there and leave it for the viewer to decide. I find that reprehensible activity. I find it irresponsible. It's irresponsible and rather cowardly. It allows plausible deniability, a term the feds love using. So these people are engaging in plausible deniability. And the way I look at it is this, right? If the viewer is the one who's trying to get the information and then digest it, share it, you know, I look at it, this is like a river, right? There's a river of truth. And the people are downstream trying to draw off to either consume or share. Podcasters are upstream. And they're putting no effort. They bring someone with them, and then they take the information, good or bad, and they throw it in the river. And they muddy the waters. And they're saying, it's not my responsibility to keep the water clean. I'm leaving it up to the viewer. I have no idea who this person is that I brought over with a bucket to throw in the river. I'm giving them no royal nod. I'm putting zero effort in. I'm leaving it to the viewer. Well, we the people need to attack those people. Because if you're telling me that you think it's easier to have to filter the mud out of the water downstream than it is to prevent the mud from going in, I'm going to tell you again, you don't understand that plumbers are smarter than you. Because this is just simple stuff. If you can keep the dirt out of the water first, then you don't have to put in the effort in. So this is simply, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We, the people, need to work together to challenge the podcasters to do their job. Stop pretending like you're a journalist and just going on the pros list and not the cons list. Journalists have some level of integrity that they put their name on something and a stamp of approval saying, I have done some work. I believe this information to be true. Doesn't mean they're always right, but you know what? At least when they're wrong, they have to come back and make an apology or an edit or a correction. But now we have all of these people that are just dumping everything into the stream and operating with this, you know, well, don't blame. It's up to the viewer to decide. That's fucked up. It's the same game being played, but the tools in the playing field have changed. You think the factions that put Doty to task are still going door to door? You think they're not invested in the internet? You think they don't step up podcasters to cause the exact same confusion? To lead people in the under, I mean, all Doty was doing was trying to convince people on a one-to-one level that the United States government does not have this technology, it's UFOs. You think they're not going to invest their money better now? You think they're not going to get one person to get more people's attention than one person? You think they're not going to step up a podcast that they can invest in heavily to get the most amount of people to pay attention to their disinformation game? I mean, this is ridiculous, the people. I mean, the fact that you and I are having this conversation, which seems to be ahead of the curve, I mean, how many more people are willing to engage this conversation and realize that disclosure is a sham? It's a total sham. It's a completely controlled narrative. They set up an agent on one side and call it a margin. They set up an agent on the other side. It's a different margin. As long as they can get everybody to discuss the bullshit between those two margins, they have effectively controlled the conversation. It's the people discussing outside of the margins that will immediately be attacked and not allowed to have their information ever inserted between the margins for the consideration of the masses. It is so obvious, it's ridiculous at this point. Lou Elizondo is self-titled the Czar of Torture. Like, to me, that sounds like something like an SS officer would be in a concentration camp. And we wouldn't think good of this person. But here we have a guy that's literally doing the exact same activity but with a different uniform on, so he gets a pass. Now all of a sudden he's not a horrible human being like a Nazi, but now we're also supposed to trust that this person has somehow changed their ways. He was a counterintelligence guy by definition. He was a torturer by definition. So this is a human being that will compromise his morals to a level Most people never would. So now people go, he wouldn't be doing that now. He wouldn't be compromising his morals for money today? I think what they're asking him to do for money right now is probably the easiest thing for him to do ever. And they're probably offering him more money now to do this than he was getting for cutting people's fingers off in Guantanamo Bay. And back to when I was at the Senate Intelligence Committee and we were discussing rogue factions. This is just starting to identify the details of what people are factioning over. You know, he will have the Gnostic faction. He will have the OTO faction. He will have the Patriots for America faction. He will have the, like, we just have all these different factions that are wielding technologies that the average person doesn't know. There is a massive battle going on between these factions and control of the masses. That's what we're caught in the throes of. That's the big conversation that the Richard Doty-like folks of today are doing due diligence to keep off of the lips and the minds of the regular people. I'll be hosting a live event February 15th in Sydney, Australia. This is my first foray, dipping my feet into the water of trying to produce a live event that is not a spectacle, that is just about the content and the information. So again, go to deciphering.tv. I'll be doing my best to share the details for this event. I hope to see folks there. And if you can't make it to there, I plan on streaming it on my website. Wish me luck. I could use all the support in this fight for the truth. And Jay, thank you very much for having me and your interest in the truth. It is appreciated.